escapes. It chides the other Russian princes for not supporting him. But it was an important epic revealing the conditions of the fighting between the Russians and the Cumans. And later, of course, it would become a great nationalistic epic in the 19th century and put to music as an opera by Borodin and Rimsky-Korsakov. But what the epic reveals is this equilibrium between the Byzantine-style Russian principalities and the Cumans, the Turkish nomads on the western steppes. And it is a standoff as the two war with each other, raid with each other. But that situation will change very, very dramatically in 1236 when Batu, the grandson of Genghis Khan, will sweep across the steppes, subject the Cumans, and plunge into Russia, and suddenly the full fury of nomadic power will be directed against the Kingdom of Hungary and Western Europe. And the future of Russia and the Western nomadic steppes will be dramatically, decisively, and abruptly changed.
Lecture 19, Islam and the Caliphate.
In this lecture, I want to shift us back to the middle regions of the steppes and also the associated civilizations in what we would today call the Middle East and India. And that requires us to refocus our attention on the urban literate civilizations that had such an important impact on nomadic peoples in the early Middle Ages. That civilization that exercised such influence on Turkish-speaking nomads of the central steppes is Islam. Islamic civilization, or to use the term caliphate, which refers to the entire institutional arrangements of Islam under the caliphs, the successors of Muhammad, that institutional Islam, the folk faith of Islam, and the culture that becomes associated with Islam, which is largely a Persian high culture, that whole package of Islam has a profound effect on the nomadic peoples. Its effects are probably as far-ranging as and as important as the impact of Buddhism, which had been received on the Silk Road, and the impact of Chinese civilization on the nomads of the Eastern Steppes. So Islam becomes, in effect, the third great religious cultural force, transforming and defining the nomadic peoples in a far more profound way than either Western or Orthodox Christianity did among the nomads of the Western steppes. Well, to address this issue, it's necessary to give some background of the emergence of the caliphate, the teachings of Muhammad, and why this Muslim civilization that emerged, really it burst upon the scene in the 7th century AD very, very dramatically in some of the most spectacular world conquests of any time. How did this civilization emerge and come to play such an important role among this, the Turkish-speaking peoples of the Eurasian steppes? Well, that requires us to back up a bit and look at a little of the career of Muhammad, the creation of the caliphate, its divisions, and above all, how the creation of a Muslim capital at Baghdad and then associated cities starting in the 8th century, 9th century, exercised a very, very important influence because of trade connections. And it's through the trade connections in the end that the nomads will receive Islam. Well, first, Muhammad is regarded as the last and the greatest of all of God's prophets, Allah. You have to remember that when Muhammad had his revelations in Mecca, probably starting at the age of 40, he essentially was a prophet and statesman at the same time. These surahs, these verses that came to him were later written down and codified and put together into the work known as the Quran, which Muslim theologians in the 9th century, especially in the city of Baghdad, determined was the uncreated word of God. that God had spoken directly through Muhammad in Arabic. And you really can't translate the Quran. The best you can do is translate the meaning of the Quran. Muhammad's strictures were rather simple, just as in the case of the revelations of Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha. And fundamentally, the first and most important call was the principle to submit to the will of God, Allah, in Arabic. And the religion came to be known as Islam, submission, and those who practiced the religion, Muslims, were those who had submitted to the fact that God had sent Muhammad late in life, according to the accounts we have in his surah, biography, and the early traditions, the Hadith. He may have been close to 40 years of age when he had these revelations, and to recognize the oneness of God and to return to the purity of the faith as it had once been preached by earlier prophets. And these earlier prophets included the prophets of Israel, above all Moses or Musa. Also Jesus, Isa, as he's called in Arabic, was recognized as a prophet. And from the very start, the Muslims did accept much of the testimony and prophecies of the Jews and the Christians, and saw themselves as the direct heirs of the religion of Abraham, or Ibrahim, as he would be called in Arabic. And Muhammad called for a new community of believers that were bound up in this new faith, submitting to the will of God, recognizing the importance of almsgiving, attempting to make a pilgrimage at least one point in life to Mecca. We'll discuss that later on. And these preachings brought Muhammad directly in conflict with the ruling clans of his native city of Mecca. Mecca had been an important caravan city, an oasis city, and its rival city was Medina. These cities had long been linked to the Roman world. They had been subject to influence by missionaries and merchants carrying both Judaism and various forms of Christianity. And Muhammad's teachings required the ending of idol worship and animal sacrifice, which had characterized Arabian cults since times immemorial. That led to conflict with the leading families that objected to this on grounds of loss of business as well as pious reasons. And in 622, Muhammad and his followers had removed themselves to the rival city of Medina. And that year, 622, is taken as the year of the migration of the flight, usually abbreviated as AH, the Anno Hegirii, the Latin rendition, and it becomes year one in this new Islamic world. Muhammad in Medina took a very important step. He had accepted Medinans, a number of merchants who had actually invited him to come to their city, and henceforth, those who believed became members of an ummah, of a single community. Some scholars have noted that Muhammad's a background as a merchant, particularly on camel caravans, was behind part of his thinking. It was almost a contractual sense coming out of commerce that all believers, all Muslims, whether they're from Medina, whether they're from Mecca, certainly questions of clan and tribe and family no longer mattered so much as the union of one faith. And eventually, Muhammad, by the time of his death in 632, had recovered Mecca and united the Arabian tribes under the banner of this new faith. Now, it is a question as to how many of the Arabian tribes really understood what their monotheism meant. That is of small consequence. Clearly, the close followers of Muhammad who succeeded to his traditions, they were convinced monotheists. They had accepted this new faith. And it was they who directed the spectacular conquests, which in less than three generations ripped away the southern and eastern provinces of the Roman Empire and overthrew the Sassanid state. The conquests are still studied from a military viewpoint. Arab chroniclers, writing long after the initial conquests, saw these victories as manifestations of the favor and will of Allah. And from their viewpoint, that was well taken. The victories of the 7th century AD confirmed Islam in the eyes of many, not just of the incipient Muslim community, but even of many of the foes who would in time convert, that this was a religion of victory. This had some sort of power that other religions might have been lacking. And the conquests were really the response, were really the result of the armies commanded by the first three caliphs. Caliph was a term that means successor. And the caliph combined both the qualities of a statesman as well as the director of the religious community, the ummah. A facile statement is often made that the caliphs were essentially emperor and pope together, and that's a bit more distorting than helpful. But whatever the case, a succession of able Arab generals, men who had actually trained in Byzantine and Sassanid armies, led these Bedouin regiments across the frontiers and won stunning victories. At the Battle of the Yarmouk, Khalid bin al-Walid, known as the Sword of Islam, annihilated the Byzantine army in Syria, and in the next several years, all of those possessions fell. Probably in the year 639, the date is debated, at the Battle of Qadisiyya, another force of Arabs, some 20,000 strong, defeated the field army of the then reigning Sassanid Shah, Yazgird III, and that army went down in defeat in a great three-day battle in which a sandstorm actually interrupted the battle and threw the Persians in disorder. The Sassanid Empire effectively collapses over the next several years. The Shah retreats east. He is eventually murdered quite ignominiously in an obscure village out in the region of Khorasan. He had attempted to get assistance from the Emperor Heraclius in Constantinople, from Taizong, the Tang Emperor. None of that materialized. And by 651, Arab armies had reached the Oxus, the Amu Darya, the traditional boundary between Iran and Transoxiana. In the west, the conquest of Syria opened up Egypt. In 641, an army crossed the Sinai, invaded Egypt. Egypt was disaffected from imperial rule, welcomed the Arab conquerors, and in the following year, in 642, Arab armies began a relentless march across North Africa. In 642, the cities of Libya submitted the old Roman provinces of Cyrenaica and Tripolitania. By 698, the city of Carthage had fallen to Arab arms, and the Arabs swept across North Africa, reached the Straits of Gibraltar, and in 711, Arab forces, and they're now their Berber allies, that is the desert nomads of North Africa, crossed into Spain, smashed the Visigothic kingdom, and overran most of Spain. At the same time, an extraordinary feat of arms was carried out when yet another Arab army crossed the Makran Desert, that horrible Gedrosian desert that gave Alexander the Great so much trouble, descended into the lower reaches of the Indus Valley, and conquered the lower Indus Valley up to the city of Multan. A spectacular conquest indeed. Within less than 100 years, approximately three generations, a new imperial power stretched from the Atlantic to the Hindu Kush. The Arabs themselves, desert nomads, had up until this point played a very limited role among the civilized states of the Middle East and North Africa. Now they were conquerors and rulers of a world empire. This great world empire put great stress on the original community as Muhammad had conceived it. As I said, Muhammad had many visions. He had many, these are called surah, many insights into how to organize this new community. But within a very rapid time, his first three successors, the Rashidun, or the rightly guided caliphs, were now saddled with a major problem of running a world empire. And a world empire that comprised largely of people who were non-Muslims. Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and as we shall see later, Buddhists, Manichaeans, and others. There was also a question of authority. Who was to follow the prophet? And three times in the 7th century, at the early stages of the Islamic Empire, a college of six electors met to choose a successor, a caliph. Now, in 632, the choice was pretty obvious. It went to the senior colleague, the second convert after Muhammad's wife, Abu Bakr, who's also a part-time camel herder. He directed the initial conquest, When he died, the college then elected a man called Omar. Omar presided over the spectacular conquest from 634 to 644. He was an accomplished general. And when he died, mortally wounded by a slave who was outraged over the victories over the Persians, since the slave was of Persian origin, Omar directed a third election, which elected a man named Uthman from a very, very prominent family, the Umayyad family, which had extensive contacts in the Arab leadership, and many of the important governorships were in the hands of this family, particularly the governor of Syria, based in Damascus, a man named Muawiyah. Well, in all three of these elections that occurred, and that would have been in 632, again in 644, and above all, that final election that put Uthman on the throne, all of those elections, on three occasions, Ali was frustrated. Ali was the first cousin of Muhammad. His father, Abu Talib, had essentially reared Muhammad. He was married to the only daughter of the Prophet, Fatima, and he saw himself as the natural successor. And in the year 656, the Arab army in Egypt mutinied over various grievances, including lack of back pay, marched on to Medina and Mecca, slew the caliph, and then offered the throne to Ali, who instantly accepted. The result were objections across the Islamic world, particularly by Muawiyah, the governor of Syria, who was related to the deceased caliph. A civil war ensues, and Muawiyah wins. Actually, Ali is done in by a group of extremists in 661. Kharijites, who mean those who go out. And these are fundamentalist Muslims who don't want to have anything to do with either side, and a plague on caliphs and anything that even smacks of monarchy. They do in Ali, but miss Muawiyah. And Muawiyah, in 661, is acclaimed caliph by the majority of the Muslims. And he is seen as a legitimate successor of Muhammad. And he and his descendants will rule henceforth from Damascus as the Umayyad caliphs over Sunni Islam, that is Orthodox Islam. Now, the defeated don't give up. The partisans of Ali, known as the Shia, go underground. Today, we would call them Shiites. There are actually several different types of dissident groups. Some are strictly Aliyids. They want to put a descendant of Ali and Fatima on the throne. Others are Shiites and related groups who want not only to overthrow the caliph, but they see this as part of the opening of a cosmic struggle, almost a Muslim apocalypse. But all of these groups are in opposition and constantly being suppressed by the Umayyad government and later by the Abbasid caliphs. The Umayyads are responsible for a lot of the initial conquest, but by the end of the 7th century, the Umayyad caliphs located in Damascus had suffered some serious reverses. They had been defeated by the Byzantines at Constantinople. They were thwarted by the Khazars along the Caucasus. And as we shall see in an upcoming lecture, they are locked in very difficult fighting with Turks over Transoxiana and that northeastern frontier that gave so much trouble to the Sassanids. And as a result, the Umayyad Caliphate, shortly after 700 AD, begins to come under severe fiscal and military pressures. It cannot keep up the pace of conquest. And in addition, the Arab tribal regiments that garrison the military towns in this expanding empire, outside of Tunis, at Fustat or Old Cairo, in the cities of lower Iraq, such as Basra, Waset, and above all, the Arab army stationed in Merv on the Oxus, that old important caravan center, going back to antiquity, all of those forces become increasingly independent and rapacious. The Arab tribal regiments were very difficult to control. Many of them harbored sympathies for Ali. Others were Shia. Also, it took a lot of effort on the part of Arab governors of these military forces to keep the Arab regiments focused on fighting the foes rather than fighting each other, because they're all tribal regiments with all sorts of blood feuds and personal quarrels between Southern and Northern Arabs. And this constantly meant that any of these military governors spent more of his time trying to keep the tribes from killing each other and trying to focus their efforts on conquering new territory for Dar al-Islam, that is the heartland of Islam, the house of Islam, from the infidels, the unbelievers, who dwelled in Dar al-Harib, or the abode, the land of war. There is this notion of the Islamic world as opposed to the non-Islamic world, which emerges very quickly in the Umayyad Caliphate. So the Umayyad Caliphate is eventually overthrown. And the overthrow comes from the east, significantly so. In the region known as Khorasan, I've mentioned it before, that's eastern Iran, that's on the border of the caravan cities. And in 749, the governor in Merv raises the black flags of rebellion against the Umayyad caliphs. This man is later known as As-Safrah, the bloodthirsty is the title he will take. And his mixed army of Arab tribal regiments and Persian converts, Mawali as they're called, the Persians have come to provide the bulk of the infantry for the Eastern Army, and that has become very evident when we discuss the difficulty of fighting the Turks and bringing Transoxiana under control. This army sweeps west and defeats the Umayyad forces, and by 750, the Umayyad dynasty has been overthrown and a new dynasty is proclaimed. This is the Abbasid state. The new caliph makes the claim he is descended from Abbas, the uncle of the prophet. And the Abbasid caliphs insist that they have this connection going back to the prophet. In the process of taking power, they've alienated a number of their allies. Many Shia and Aliyids join the so-called Abbasid revolution to overthrow the hated Umayyad caliphs, only to find them saddled with yet another monarchy. An Abbasid caliph who was studiously and carefully Sunni in his religious beliefs. And so all of the animosity that these groups once had against the Umayyads is now transferred again to the Abbasids. The Abbasids proved to be the most successful of the medieval dynasties. They are the third and greatest line of caliphs. They will be eliminated by the Mongol sack of Baghdad in 1258. Several significant points about the Abbasid caliph dictate the future relationships between this emerging Islamic world and the nomadic peoples of the steppes. The second caliph, Al-Mansur, moves the capital from Damascus to Baghdad. That was a very significant move. It announced that this new line of caliphs really had no interest in conquering Constantinople and becoming heir to the Roman Empire. Instead, they created a capital very close to the ancient city of Ctesiphon, where the Parthians had once ruled and the Sassanid Persians, and that new capital put the new Muslim dynasty essentially in a Persian cultural world. The Abbasid caliphs, in effect, adopted much of the high culture of Sassanid Persia. Many of their political institutions and pretensions really can be traced back to the shahs of Sassanid Iran. Furthermore, they turned their empire from an Arabic empire into a Muslim empire. Something like 34 of the 37 Abbasid caliphs were the sons of slaves, non-Arab slaves, most of them Persians, and they appreciated, above all, the Persian converts, who not only provided infantry, but a lot of the administrators, and as we shall see in an upcoming lecture, many of the thinkers who are responsible for the flowering of Islamic civilization in the reign of Harun al-Rashid. And he rules from 786 to 811. He is the caliph known to most Westerners in the tales of the 1001 Arabian Nights, and his reign is seen as the apex of Abbasid civilization, of a Muslim empire, as opposed to just a Arabic empire, where only the Arabs had privileged positions. An empire where all who served the caliph and who professed the true faith were welcome. And it's this vision of this great, tolerant, powerful empire that influences many calls back to traditional Islam that are made today. And in order to understand that current political ideology, you have to have some understanding of how they view the Abbasid state. Well, this Abbasid state had certain weaknesses. For one, there were still the rival opponents, mostly Alid and Shiite opponents. There were other extremists. They went underground and they opposed the emperor and the caliph in Baghdad. In addition, the unity of the Abbasid state was always questionable from the start. It really comprised two halves. It comprised the former Roman Empire in North Africa, the East, and Spain. In fact, the Abbasid caliph ruled more of the former Roman Empire than the emperor in Constantinople did. So that was one half. And then there was Arabia, the homeland. And then there was the Eastern or Iranian half. And these two parts eventually went their separate ways, with the Abbasid caliphs ruling from Baghdad, which had been really the capital from at least 762. It's the main mint. It's where most of the activities of the caliph and his administration are centered. And what happened over the course of the 8th and 9th and 10th centuries is the Abbasid state fragmented. Various powerful men, and we'll meet some of them in the upcoming lectures, particularly in Iran and Transoxiana, which slowly comes under Islamic rule, known as emirs, governors, styled themselves as agents of the caliph, obtained what is called a firman, and ruled in his name. This political fragmenting began after the death of Harun al-Rashid. His death marked a great civil war, a civil war that pitted his two sons, al-Amin and al-Mamun. And al-Mamun, who is actually the son of a Persian concubine slave, wins. But he wins with the help of the Eastern Army in Khorasan, particularly from members of what are known as the Tariyid family. And they set themselves up as essentially independent emirs. They, in turn, give way in Khorasan to a new group of rulers, again, Persian converts. We know them as the Samanidid emirs, and they represent, again, converts to early Islam. The founder of this group, and he's given, in effect, a firman in 813, is a perfectly good Sunni emir. His name is Ahmed. He claims descent from his grandfather Saman, therefore we call it the Samanid emirs. They will rule from Bukhara and play a very, very important cultural role in the development of Islam in Iran and Transoxiana, the very Islamic culture that is carried to the nomads of the steppes. So by the early 9th century, the Abbasid state is politically breaking up. All of these Sunni emirs recognize the caliph in Baghdad, who is increasingly a religious figure. But they have become, in effect, independent rulers. At the same time, there are other would-be rivals to the Abbasid caliph. These represent various dissident groups. Some of them have been traced back to pre-Islamic apocalyptic groups. You get some rather colorful figures revolting against the Abbasid authority in the early 9th century. One of my favorite ones is the so-called Green Prophet, who has all sorts of bizarre millenarian visions. But the prime group that was the real danger to the Abbasid caliphs were the Aliyids. That is, those groups who had organized themselves in cells and wanted to overthrow Abbasid authority. These groups could penetrate the guilds, could penetrate the trade networks across the Abbasid empire, and we'll be discussing the important role of trade in the Abbasid empire in an upcoming lecture. Very, very